This Twin Peaks Investing Podcast is brought to you in association with SharePad from ShareScope, the UK's number one investment data and analysis software for private investors and traders. Visit ShareScope.co.uk and discover the advantage.
Hello and welcome to the Twin Peaks Investing Podcast. My name is Peter Higgins. You can find me at Conkers3. And I'm here with my good colleague, Peter Wheely Dealer, at Wheely Dealer on Twitter. How you doing, Pete?
Yeah, not bad, mate. Not bad at all.
Good, good, good. Hello and welcome, everyone. This is Twin Peaks Investing Podcast number 54. So we're cracking the numbers on and we're moving on. And I'm not going to say who we've got, but we've got a very, very special guest with us later in this particular podcast, an overseas guest. We're very, very privileged to have him join us, and he's going to be joining us in about 10 minutes or so, but I'll let you know a bit more about him later on. But Pete and I are going to start, as we normally do, with a little bit of a background as to how the markets have been. When we spoke in podcast 53, Pete and I were having a conversation as to direction of the markets. I was a bit concerned about, you know, low volatility of low volume of summer markets and the fact we could be flat to declining. And on that day, we actually did it a day early. We usually do it on a Wednesday, which is what we're doing it today, Wednesday the 28th. We actually recorded the last podcast on the 13th, the Tuesday, because Pete had a planned visit to the pub, and we know he loves his pub. So we recorded it on the Tuesday. And when we did that on that day, the FTSE 100 was sitting at 7124, and a bit of volatility, a bit of noise, various conversations about inflation this and inflation that. There was some talk about the dreaded C word, COVID numbers and Delta variant. We're not going to talk about that too much. But we had the markets fall on July the 19th and July the 20th. And FTSE went to 6823 on the 19th. That was around that sort of approximation of a low.
That was the Monday, wasn't it?
That was the Monday. That was
a real spanking. Yep. I think we all had a bit of a reminder that the bears are still around.
The bears are still around, yeah. And the following day, it went up a little bit again that day. That was the intraday low, went up a bit. And then we had another low again, 6836 on the Tuesday. So a lot of people were gnashing their teeth on the Monday and Tuesday of that week after the podcast. Some people were down and have been down 1% or 2% those 2 days. So it wasn't very good for people. Lots of people were worrying. FTSE 250 did similar. We had a read of 22,926 on the 13th of July. The low again, since we last spoke, was on the 19th of July, 21,938, at a higher low on the 20th of July of 22,018 on the 20th. I must say today we've come back a bit on the FTSE 100. We're back to 7,016. So we're just about above that magic figure that we've been bouncing backwards and forwards on of 7,000. So we're back there. The FTSE 250 is above where it was on the 13th. It's at 23,006 today's close. And also we've got the AIM, Pete.
Yeah.
We spoke about the AIM, didn't we? And we're back above where we were where are we? On the 13th. We're back above that, thereabouts regarding that.
I get the impression that the markets at the moment, in terms of the UK markets, I think really we're just sort of going sideways. And the thing that, because every night, and people who follow me on Twitter will have seen this, every night I put out some tweets, you know, usually sort of like 10:30 at night or something. I put out a string of tweets about what I'm seeing on the indices. And the thing that's really hit me in recent days is the volume. I've tried to use as colourful words as I can, but I mean, the best word is embarrassing. I mean, some of the volumes, they're barely even visible on the chart, you know, and it's I think when you've got these low volumes, you can get all sorts of weird stuff going on. But I don't think anything dramatic will happen with such low volume. I don't think we'll get a big fall. Equally, I don't think we'll get necessarily a big rise, you know?
I think that's a possibility, Pete. I still think there's a few things out there, and we've seen a few warnings from the likes of Reckitt Benckiser, Unilever the other day. There's lots of input costs, logistic costs that have been rising, and I was going to touch on this a bit later on, but there's a conversation to be had, I think, as well, because one of the things that's significantly going to change going forward. Well, two things are going to change going forward. I'm going to mention this later on, but I might as well throw this in now. Is that on the 1st of August, yeah, employers, right? So if you think about every listing company is basically an employer of somebody. The UK ones especially, they must start paying back, yeah, and must start making a 20% contribution to the wages of furloughed employees under the coronavirus job retention scheme. And that's on top of regular pension and national insurance contributions, Pete. So if the costs have been biting them before, and they've been managing because of furlough payments have been keeping them, you know, they're going to have to contribute those again going forward.
See, I wonder if something like that, for starters, it's very sector specific. And those sectors, you know, like the hospitality and the airlines or something, they're pretty beat up anyway. So they're relatively, compared to other stocks that make up an index, they're relatively low weightings. So if they were to drop a bit, it may not necessarily pull the index down. You see what I mean?
They might have a low weighting, but the point I'm trying to make is that every employer has to make that contribution now if they've got staff that's furloughed at 20%. And the other thing that's kicking in, Pete, on the 31st of July, yeah. All those mortgage holidays and consumer credit holidays end in the UK on the 31st of July. So people that have not been paying the mortgages, that comes to an end.
Yeah.
So the people that have saved, I don't know, £500 per month for the last 18 months, hopefully they've got that money ready to start paying the mortgages. But if they haven't and they've done whatever they've done with it, they're going to have to start paying that mortgage going forward as well. So that's going to have a knock-on effect with people being able to put additional monies to the market, I think, for those that have been punting that money on the market, some various different indices, they might have to start thinking about paying the mortgages again properly.
I guess it's all about the fuzziness of macro. So you've got those kind of things that are potentially negative for everything. But I think on the flip side, you've got a lot of positives in the... For instance, the COVID situation seems to be, let's touch with lots of wood and whatever, there are some good signs coming out. And things like, you know, today I was seeing how they're letting cruise ships, you know, do proper cruising and stuff. And the bloke from the CEO of Heathrow was on something I saw on telly. And he was saying he's now up to 65% of their normal capacity that they can normally do, i.e. including USA and Europe, because of the changes to quarantine rules. And that's up from like 25% of their addressable market. So I think there's all these sort of positive factors as well. So it's such a fuzzy picture, as we always say.
It's fuzzy, mate. I'm probably going to be on the bearish side of things and say, with regards to the COVID situation, I'm hoping to be completely wrong on this. But my fear is that we're going to have the numbers are dropping in the last couple of days. But I suspect that once everybody starts to go on holiday, socialise here, there and everywhere, I think we're going to have a spike in August / if not September. So I think that it's going to be short lived, Pete. I want to be wrong.
That's funny, because that totally chimes with the whole stance I've got at the moment. My stance at the moment is really do nothing but be cautious. Because I think if we do get a sell-off, it will be towards the end of August, September, October, which are traditionally a difficult period. And I discussed this a lot. I think it was on TPI 53. I talked a lot about this. And what I mean, for instance, this morning, we said we're doing this on Wednesday, 28th. I trimmed part of my Pets at Home position that I've got as a spread bet. So obviously it's leverage. It's got a lot of risk in it. And I just thought, I'm not comfortable with the amount I've got as a leverage spread bet. So I just reduced it a bit. I've still got a load and I've still got loads of shares, but they've actually got results tomorrow on the 29th. And even though I really like pets, I don't want to go into results with a really big leverage position, because if there is any bad news, it will absolutely spank my backside.
Well, you tend to bring pets up a lot, Pete. And the bizarre thing is today, my family and I, well, not me directly, have contributed to Pets at Home's revenue. I think they'll probably add it to the next set of results or trading update. But my daughter has come back with the whole shebang and a little hamster, mate. Bugging me. I'm like, no, not having one. But there's two females in the house and just me, mate, and it just does weigh you down. So the best thing to do eventually is just say, okay. You know, so we've got a hamster in the house. It's all come from Pets at Home. So I don't know. I dare to even ask how much all the kits cost, mate. It's not that expensive, no doubt. But we've contributed, Pete. So there you go. Before we get to Seth, I wanted to say a couple of things here, because you were mentioning, and we were talking in the last one, markets wise, about the S&P 500. And I wanted to mention that on the 13th, that was at 4369. Yeah. It went to 4258 on the 19th. Yeah. And today it's back above where it was on the 13th at 4399. And the bizarre thing I just thought this was odd. I saw a diagram that showed the S&P 500, its components, and 50%, almost 50% of the component weighting of the S&P 500 was what? Apple.
Wow.
Yeah, and I'll talk about Apple a bit later on, because Apple and Google have had some results over the last couple of days. I'll talk about that a bit later on. But we should get our guest on, Pete, should we not?
Yeah, let's go for it. Let's get the man on.
Right. Okay, folks. I'm really, really chuffed and really, really pleased. I almost want to start singing a song like Straight Out of Compton, but it's not from Compton. It's from Brooklyn, New York, and this chap is called Seth Levine, and he's at Seth Levine 2 on Twitter. So if you guys can find his Twitter handle, I would very much recommend that you probably follow him. Seth is a professional institutional investor. He's also the creator of the Integrating Investor website, where he writes about macroeconomic and investment strategy related themes. Seth's hosts a weekly YouTube show, also called The Integrated Investor, where he further explores these topics and interviews other investment professionals in order to flesh out their investment framework. Seth holds a Bachelor of Science degree in Mechanical Engineering from Cornell University and is an CFA charter holder. And you can learn more about Seth as his website, which is www.integratedinvestor.com. And we're very, very chuffed to have him, blessed to have him. And we'll talk a bit more about Seth. Seth, are you there, mate?
Yeah, I'm here. Thanks. Thanks a lot for that that glowing introduction. I appreciate that. I guess being from, living in Brooklyn and living in New York City, I guess that would make me more of a Biggie Smalls guy just based on geography alone. So,
well, Biggie Smalls is good for me, mate. I'd like a bit of Biggie. You know, I'm not going to ask you to sing on this one, though, because I think Pete's got an impression you're from Maroon 5, but you're not, are you?
Yeah, maybe. I probably look more like Maroon 5 than anything else. So.
Cool. I don't know any of the bands you've mentioned so far. are they bands or what?
Oh, that's it's a big it's that was you know, I'm you know, I'll date myself here. I'm in my early 40s, and when I was growing up, the pop culture was East Coast U.S. versus West Coast U.S. Hip hop. So you had the L.A. kind of Straight out of Compton crew, and on one side, and they hated the New York guys, you know, which was like Biggie Smalls and I guess Puff Daddy and what have you. And you know, there's a huge pretty unfriendly rivalry there. So yeah, that's that reference.
We've got a load of listeners, and there's one, a guy called Apple Bottom Beans, a really good guy, Jason, and he's a huge fan of rap, so he'll be absolutely ecstatic when he hears this.
I'm good. Yeah, he's probably well more versed than I am.
Cool. So Seth, I'm glad you liked the intro. Just tell us a little bit about yourself and then the company you work for and what you do, and then we'll get into some shenanigans about markets and other topics, please, mate.
Yeah, sure. Maybe this is a good time just to state first that these are just my personal views. These are not my it's not trading advice. It doesn't These are not the views of my employer or really anyone else. These are just my own opinions, and kind of do your own work before you invest. Do not rely on anything I'm going to say as investment advice. Figure I got to throw that out for
Cool.
the good old regulators keeping us safe.
Absolutely.
But yeah, but the reason why that was a good time to put it to bring it up is, so I've been a professional investor for over 17 years in the US. I've worked kind of in traditional kind of Wall Street jobs, and as well as as well as on the institutional side, that's known as the buy side. So I invest for an institution, and I've seen a lot of just a lot of stuff in my career. I had over my career a pretty varied background, and because of this sort of the variety that I saw, I'm a guy who takes kind of ideas seriously, and one thing I noticed kind of coming out of the great financial crisis is a lot of the theories and a lot of the expectations that people had for the craziness of that time, right? And I'm sure your viewers will remember kind of what was going on there. We had
Oh, yeah.
massive QEs that were quantitative easings, which were new, right? No one That has never been done before, and there was a lot of speculation in terms of what the impact would that that those would have on the markets and economies. There was the same in Europe, right? I mean, that was you had all the sovereign debt crisis over there. So there was a lot of theories and a lot of big events going on. And what I realized was, a lot of the things that I expected to happen or believed would happen sort of didn't, right? So it kind of
I
feels,
know that. I know that feeling because that's exactly how I felt about it. Definitely.
and well, yeah, definitely not alone, right? There was a lot of people who are really curious, like, why, what should I do with my money? Why aren't things unfolding as I expect? And so that led me to starting a blog, which is the Integrating Investor, that you reference, and that's kind of how I'm on Twitter, and that's led me to a show, and that's just been a fantastic venue for me personally. Again, this is outside of kind of my day job to really work through some of these investment ideas that kind of I'd kind of gleaned over the years. I kind of call them investing heuristics that I'd picked up, just kind of emulating people who I worked with who are successful and books that I've read, and really, I had to kind of work through them and kind of build my own framework. So I really just kind of started with a blank sheet of paper, or I guess in this sense, a website, and I just really started to dive into areas of explanation that interest me at the time in order to just try to build out a better investment process.
Do you know, it's really interesting you say that because I don't know if you've seen it. I run a website as well, Wheelie Dealer. And I found a very, I mean, I've been running my website for probably 7 years now, and I've been on Twitter at pretty much the same time. And I found a really similar thing in a way that it was like doing Wheelie Dealer opened me up to loads of other investors, like yourself. We're speaking now. That would never have happened
Right.
if I hadn't have done it. And obviously with Peter. And that's enabled me to learn different ways of doing things and to question my own beliefs and all that kind of stuff. And as you say, actually, the process of writing a blog, it sort of forces you to think about things and to sort of think things through in your mind and whatever. And I find that a really useful, as you say, framework, process for my own investing.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And there's nothing more terrifying than trying to put than looking at what the ideas are in your head, right? Just putting down on a piece of paper, and then you just go, "Huh, that doesn't really make any sense."
I do that a
But
lot.
it's terrifying, but it's a lot of work. But at the end, you actually get to kind of unscramble your brain a little bit, which for me was quite scrambled. So it's been great.
I read a post you did, and then you commented to me on it on Twitter, and you, in the post, you it was about cryptocurrencies and NFTs and stuff, and the macroverse, yeah? And yeah. You said at the start of it that you were sort of looking into a subject that you'd previously perhaps not understood as well, and you wanted to learn about it. And I found that a really interesting statement, because I find that myself a lot, that it's like sometimes I'll see a share, a stock going up, and I think, what the hell am I missing? This is a piece of junk. Why is this piece of junk going up? And sometimes, once I actually take the time and the effort to understand it, I realized that my previous beliefs were wrong and they were misconceptions. And quite often, you know, I perhaps should have invested in it, or maybe I even do, you know, as a result of me doing more research.
Yeah, and that's a really astute observation, because the whole reason why I wrote that article, I think it's it should be the most recent one on my site, about the metaverse, right? The metaverse, yeah, and NFTs, right? These are these crypto, I'll just call them like cryptocurrency offshoots. Concepts, I guess, or you'll just kind of leave them aside. And you know, I'd heard these things mentioned over the months, right? They're not that old, so maybe a year, you know, a year or two, and over the months. And I've done my own sort of really deep diving into crypto over the years. I've been kind of around the hoop since 2011, I was actually, because of an interview that I did on my YouTube show, where someone was talking about it, and I was like, you know what? Like, I kind of kicked this to the curb as kind of like tech bro speak, you know, like that kind of like Silicon Valley, like, you know, you kind of like you utopian, going to change the world kind of talk. And the skeptic in me was like, okay, whatever. But then, you know, I finally forced myself to dig in. And what I realized is, you know, it's kind of like it's one of those things that are kind of full of half truths, right? There's some really interesting developments, I think, in that metaverse NFT space, which, you know, we could get into or not. And there's a lot of BS there as well. So it's fascinating.
This is a quick hello to you, our valued Twin Peaks Investing podcast listener. Whatever channel you're listening to, please make sure to subscribe, and you'll always be the first to get the new episodes. Thank you for your continued support.
What I find interesting, Seth, is when this NFT thing kicked off, a bit like blockchain and Bitcoin and all the other cryptos, is that there's so many people that go, this is the new thing. And there's other people on that, not necessarily sitting on the fence, but completely polarized on the opposite side, go, this is just complete nonsense. And then, you know, I think you've touched on it in one of your posts before. I think one of the pieces of art, NFT, was it called Beeple? Was that the right name?
Went
for $69 million.
Yes.
You know, there's various artists out there, but most of them, the good ones, have, you know, passed a long time ago. Their art still isn't selling for that kind of money. And someone puts together a collage and it goes for $69 million. It's like, what is wrong with the world? You know, I
mean, and just to make it clear to listeners, this piece of art that went for whatever it was, $69 million, by Beeple, it's actually digital art. It's not like a painting or anything. It's like a sort of painting you can only see on a computer. And the thing is, anyone can see it for free. So it's all a bit weird, really.
That is
digital
true.
Property,
yeah.
Pete. Digital property.
Digital property. Yeah. And so that's been fascinating too. And like, you know, what I've realized is just this whole, even post COVID, post the great financial crisis, you know, it's just been so pregnant for me for topics of figuring out what I thought I know about investing and what I don't. And like Bitcoin was a great example too. I can start off there, is that, you know, I had first heard about Bitcoin in like 2011, right? And like, that was pretty new back then. I was like listening to podcasts and like, you know, I was kind of on the fringe of the scene. I was never in the scene, but yeah, I went and I remember I bought some Bitcoin early on. And because you haven't heard the rest of the story. It was just rocketing. It was skyrocketing up.
Billionaire.
Yeah, exactly, right? And it was just rocketing up, and it was going up to like $1,000. And I was like, you know what? Like, let me get my hands dirty a little bit and see what this is, because if I'm not, you know, invested dollar wise, it's just gonna, you know, I'm never gonna learn anything,
right? Yeah.
So then, lo and behold, this was, you know, again, probably, you know, not long after the Chinese government cracked down on Bitcoin, and the price just collapsed. It went from like over $1,000 to like $250. And I was like, you know what? Wow, that's stunning. Because what happened to all the, you know, we can't kill cryptocurrency, right? It's above governments. So all of a sudden, this price collapse occurred. So that was the first lesson for me where I was like, well, there, maybe I don't know what I think I know about cryptocurrency. So I've actually changed my views pretty dramatically over the years with cryptocurrency. I've kind of written about it too, where I see it as kind of both a, you know, what I'll call a momentum play, meaning people are, you know, you could buy it because other people are buying it, right? If anyone, I don't know if you guys are familiar with the term trading sardine, it's made popular by a Seth Klarman book. But
I've heard the expression, yeah, trading sardines.
Yeah, yeah, it yeah. basically means something that has no utility value but goes up in price because other people want it. And, you know, yeah. it's very much like, you know, perhaps the Beeple artwork. Like to me, there's an investing thesis that could be made based on that. Like that, I think, is legitimate, the momentum and people coming into the space and bidding up these digital assets.
Yeah.
And then I also have this view of, okay, what is the value proposition of it, right? What's the real utility of cryptocurrency? And because ultimately, you know, all money, all currency, all everything has to come back to human life, right? Like, we are human. These are human inventions. They have to serve our life. And what is the value that they serve, right? So yeah. that's kind of a long-winded way of going around crypto and changing. Yeah.
Interesting you use the word utility. Have you done much sort of, I guess, because of your institutional background, I'm thinking, have you done much like formal education in economics and stuff?
Oh, man, that's an interesting question. I mean, no. So I was an engineering major. I had no formal education in economics, basically, yeah. prior to my professional career. I just started off in the investing world, kind of in, you know, as an assistant. I mean, literally like an admin on a team, and I kind of worked my way up, you know, over the years to senior analyst.
Yeah.
And so no formal investing, no formal education there. But, you know, I educated myself. You know, I started reading what I thought was, you know, this. You know, I started reading, you know, at first kind of the Austrians that just kind of spoke to me more. And specifically Mises. Yeah, I was kind of a von Mises guy. Not that I have anything against Hayek. And then, you know, I started reading a little bit of Minsky as well, pretty recently. Yeah. And, you know, it's funny. So you have kind of like the Austrian, you know, I have like the Austrian view. I have that, kind of new Keynesian, I'll call it appreciation, because while I disagree with a lot of kind of that Keynesian economic view of the world, I do think that Minsky specifically had a very good understanding of the banking sector, and yeah. and not only the banking, you know, as a result, that gave me some good insight into the financial sector, and really kind of melding that all together. It's funny. I've started to meld my own or really forge my own views of money over the years.
Yeah.
And very specifically, very recently, I should say. And that has led me to have just very different views of a lot of common concepts, yeah. That seem to suit me better, and suit me best, I would say, kind of, or more consistent with the way I think. And, you know, like one of them right now that's front and center is inflation. Right.
Yeah.
You know, you can't go anywhere without hearing about inflation. And
what's your sense on inflation then?
Yeah. So my sense of it is, and I hate to say it, but I agree with the central banks here, where I believe it's transitory.
You, mate, so you can say it all day.
Okay. Yeah.
Let's get some confirmation bias.
Yeah, but it's like, why do I think inflation is transitory? It's not for the it's not that I'm a fan of the central banks. It's not that I think they're doing anything right. I mean, quite honestly, like, I am a pretty hardcore radical laissez-faire capitalists. Like, I believe that markets that the government should be hands off on the economy, except for from a contracts right perspective. So me agreeing with the Fed, it seems like very, very strange to me on the surface until I dig in. And really, what I've sort of come to the conclusion is that people, and this goes echo to what you were saying, Pete, about unscrambling kind of what's in your head, is that I had a very scrambled view of inflation. Right. What is the definition of inflation? Like, what are we really talking about here? Right. Inflation. And if you ask people what they mean by inflation, you find that it's not so straightforward. Right. Yeah. And there's really kind of two sort of unrelated concepts, in my view, that relate at periods of times that people have. And the first one being this concept of prices rising, right? We have this, like the CPI here in the U.S. or the PPC or PCI or, whatever your favorite basket is.
Based on a basket of household items or whatever, and I'm not sure how representative it really is.
Exactly, right? It's kind of picked and chosen and adjusted. Yeah. But it's supposed to represent kind of, what the average person, whatever that means, kind of spends on their daily life. And, obviously, prices going up is scary, right? I mean, your cost of living is going down. Mm. But then there's this other concept, and it's very different, of this concept of inflation being a monetary debasement. Right. And what that means, like, it's your loss of purchasing power, right? Irrespective of what's going on in the world. Like, this is very much a political concept where you have a government or an authority or, a king or an emperor, they would go back and literally change the value of that money. So whatever everyone had is automatically worth less in inflation, in an inflationary environment, right? Your money was debased.
So that's less about supply not being able to keep up with demand of goods and services. That's more about the sort of money supply and there just being too much money sloshing around.
Right. And specifically government created money, which I think is an important distinction. Right. And if you look back, to the real history and the classical examples, like for me, one of the best ones is Rome. Kind of the Roman Empire. I'm not going to get this right for any history buffs out there. I apologize. Yeah. At one point, the Roman kind of coin, it was the denarius, I believe. It was something like 95% silver. Again, don't quote me on the numbers, but directionally. Right? And then by the end of one of the emperors, right, it went through a series of emperors, as Rome was on the decline, a series of inflations, whereas it went from about like 95% silver to 0.05% silver, right?
Wow.
So this piece of currency that you had that was made of precious metal, and you could argue whether that's a whole separate issue, but it had this value. All of a sudden, the value was literally taken away by the sovereign. And there's a lot of examples of this. You have kings, monarchs clipping coins throughout time and whatnot. So you have these two different concepts back to inflation, and I apologize if I'm rambling here, but inflation
it's all good stuff. Don't worry.
Okay, good. Yeah. So what I found, digging into my own view of inflation is I had this scrambled view. Like, what do we mean inflation, right? On one hand, I'm holding on to this concept of monetary debasement, right? It's sort of this government issue, right? It's horrible, right? On the other hand, you have this concept of goods and this basket of goods and services that go up and down.
Yeah.
Now it's weird to me. It's weird to me that a basket of goods and services in general is going to go up and down at the same time together, right? And you look at sort of the components of like CPI today, right? Rents and hospitals and electronics and autos and all these things, they're all moving in different directions at different times, right?
Yeah, and to different extents.
It's totally different, right? And now I'm sure you and your audience can appreciate this, right? Like, I've been a fundamental investor. for over 17 years, right? You guys are fundamental investors. Like, I know that prices that companies charge go up and down for all sorts of reasons, right?
Yeah.
And right, and they don't really care so much about prices so much as they care about revenues, or they care about profit margins, right? So the whole, in the arc of human history, right, falling prices is the hallmark of prosperity, right? The fact that people and central bankers are getting all worked up about CPI declines, right? The basket, like, our consumer products getting cheaper is bizarre to me, right? It's just
I think, Seth, I think the main problem we've got, and I've had this discussion with many people in the past, is that our central bankers, the Bank of England, the Bank of America, they keep moving the goalpost and they keep putting different things in the basket. And right. They're concerned about oversupply and then undersupply, and they keep making it up as they go along. And the problem I've got with it at the minute, and I'm hoping it's transitory, as you've said, is that you've got US inflation sitting at 5.4% right now. Yeah. You've got UK inflation sitting at 2.5 or thereabouts. If it stays there long enough, it means that the actual cost implications and the actual static that's causing these companies to be either an extra 2.5% profitable or less profitable ekes into the market, ekes into the bottom line that you, I, and every taxpayer earns. Yeah. And eventually the market goes, actually, this has been here longer than we want it to be. Every time we've had a spike in inflation in the UK and the US, it's eventually come down. That transitory period differs each time. So whether it's for 3 months, 6 months, or a year, it differs each time. So transitory could be short and it could be long.
Yeah, I think that's a great point too, Pete. Like, I don't disagree with anything you said. What you said is not inconsistent with actually my view of inflation at all, and not inconsistent with my view of inflation being transitory. So let's look at that basket of goods now, right? Now, when we say inflation today, we have to realize that we're talking about the change in these CPI like terms, right? So when I say inflation, we're going to talk about that's what I mean. We have to throw the monetary debasement concept out the window, because it doesn't, in my view, and we could touch upon it later, it doesn't really apply to this fiat currency regime, because there is no monetary standard, right? We just print money, and it's not really connected to anything, right? And that's a whole nother ball of wax that we can get into if you like. But yeah, I mean, that's a good point, right? So prices are going up today, and they're going up pretty steep. The question I first ask myself is, why are they going up today, right? Okay, well, that's a very complicated question. Are they going up today because of the central bank? Are they going up today because of what government is doing? Or are they going up today because of what's going on in the economy? And for me, I take a look around. You know, we've had extraordinary, and I would say highly irresponsible reactions from central banks and governments that are inconsistent with my framework for the world and what a process world means for over a decade, right? Since the great financial crisis and before. That's not necessarily new to me. I don't agree with it. I think it's bad, right? That's not new to me. But this spike of inflation today, and especially being a fundamental guy and listening to how companies are talking about their own operations, to me seems more related to supply chain issues and commercial conditions rather than monetary and fiscal conditions. So when I look out in the world, I think these spikes in inflation are relating to the shortages that we're seeing, the issues that we're seeing in the economy, ex government. And that's what actually gives me the I'll say confidence, loose confidence, right? We strong views held loosely in investments always, that this is transitory, because whenever I've seen a company face higher prices or an industry face higher prices, the same thing happens, right? There's no better cure for higher prices than higher prices, absent any kind of intervention. And, if you look back to like 2013, 2014, when oil spiked through the roof, right? It exceeded $120 a barrel here in the U.S. What cured that, right? There was it brought on the it brought on the shale boom, right? The shale revolution, and a ton of extra joint capacity, and that just collapsed the price of oil, you know, even to depths that I didn't even think was possible, right? It was negative in the futures market, you know, just over a year ago. So
absolutely. I mean, the other thing, Seth, and a really good recent example was Pete and I have spoken on here on this podcast about, you call it lumber in the US, we call it timber here, but lumber prices absolutely rocketed and went up and up and up to the point where some construction wasn't getting done because people were just refusing to pay the price. And that's just reversed and come down 50-60% from its peak. So that's a really good example as well.
It was really interesting too. I'm going to reference a friend's article that I saw. They looked at I'm forgetting the name of it. I apologize, but I could shoot that to you if anyone's interested. They looked at the difference between lumber prices, right? So or timber prices, right? The finished goods, right? How much for a board of lumber versus the stumpage price, which was actually the trees, right? If you look at the trees, and what they found is, the inflation was in the processing, right? It was in turning the trees into lumber boards, right? It wasn't in the stumpage. Like, the price of the actual raw material trees hadn't changed at all. It was in the lumber, right? So again, to me, that was another signal that this isn't a sort of generic inflation of all goods and services rising in price together because of the actions of government, but rather there's some sort of supply chain issue, some sort of production issue that's going on, in this case specifically the lumber, in the converting the raw material into actual a usable commodity. And to me, it just screamed COVID, right? Again, social distancing, plants cut down, whole shutdown of everything, and you know where the productive capacity was really hampered here in the U.S. And then all of a sudden, like a light switch, it came all back on at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, it's had a fantastic round trip, that lumber prices. I've just pulled up a chart here.
Oh yeah,
going back to July of 2020, and it was sitting there at $500 per 100 board feet. Lumber future prices went all the way up to $1,600 for the same, and now it's back down to about $560. So it's had a proper round trip, you know, volatile. So yeah,
guys, I think
some futures traders made some serious wedge there, Seth.
Yeah,
I've got another example of exactly what Seth was saying. The UK house builders have been putting out results, and the really strange thing is that they're all pretty relaxed about inflation. And there's a very good reason for it. It's because the price of their raw materials, as in timber to build the wooden joists and the bricks and whatever, is going up. But the thing is, the cost of building a house isn't just the price of wood and bricks. There's a huge component of the cost, which is labor and cement and administration and all sorts of nonsense that's built into the cost of producing a house. So you can have inflation in a particular bit, but it doesn't actually move the dial much when you take it to the bigger picture.
That's an interesting point too. And, you know, I should clarify, you know, when I say transitory, right, it's more of a I mean that more in an abstract sense, and you know, that's not to say it's useless and by any means. It's going, you know, and lumber is a great example, right? Home prices is a good example. Look, every company whose earnings call I listened to in the first quarter and I'm listening to in the second quarter thus far is raising prices. They're raising prices because their input costs are going up. And quite honestly, everyone's raising prices. So that gives a lot of these companies cover to raise prices. So we could see high prices, right? We could see inflation, you know, for a while. You know, I don't think this is necessarily like a 3-month, 2-month issue, you know, 1 or 2 quarter issue. Yeah. Like, it could go on it could persist for a while. But to me, this isn't the nature of that inflation. To me, will likely trend down. Hence be transitory at some point, because again, it's related to supply and demand issues. and not monetary issues, right? This isn't like a Weimar Republic issue. This isn't a Zimbabwe. This isn't a Venezuela that we're looking at, despite all the crazy stuff that our fiscal and monetary authorities are doing. I'm sorry?
Our economies aren't that good.
Seth, I'm conscious that we've had you on here for half an hour now, and we might need to bring you back for a part two. What I wanted to ask you with regards to inflation / QE, for those of our listeners that want to get their teeth into this a bit more, is there any articles or books you would highly recommend that they probably try and purchase that you're aware of?
Oh, man. I mean, it's so hard because everyone has their own path, right?
Yes.
You know, I'll tell you this. I mean, this is going to come off like a shameless plug, but I will lay it all out there.
Go
you know,
for
kind
it.
Of
Go
how
for
I it. How I sort of came to this is, you know, on my YouTube show, it's called The Integrating Investor. You could just pop it in YouTube there and find it, or it's on my website under the media section. I did a couple episodes on inflation where I sort of lay out my views. I'm doing a multi-part. I think I'm going to be up to part three on Friday. Show on money, like I'm really laying out my ideas of money, and you know, maybe check that out and see if that resonates with you. Otherwise, for me, like I kind of had to start with the Austrians, but really, I also had kind of a little philosophical help in there, you know, from philosophy and trying to understand kind of, you know, what you know. This is going to be nerdy, but kind of like how to understand concepts better and kind of putting all that together is kind of what led me here. And really just starting with my own observations, having a kind of logical thought process, and then taking different things from different people and trying to build something that just made more sense to me. But I'd be happy to, you know, if anyone has any questions, you know, they want direct resources, you know, feel free to reach out. I'm pretty approachable.
No, I really, really appreciate that, Seth. Pete, do you have a final question for Seth?
Well, quick couple of things to throw in. If people listening on the podcast are sort of new to the whole economics thing, I would suggest get a really basic book like Economics for Dummies just to start you off, you know what I mean? And that'll give you a good grounding and some very basic concepts that are really important. The other thing I was going to say is something for you, Seth, that you might find an interesting thought. Over the years, I've been really getting into simplifying how I do things. And I'm now more of the view that the macro stuff is too difficult and too complicated and far too many moving parts for me to really understand. And so what I do more now, even though I'm still fascinated by economics and I love the subject, I tend to be driven very much by what the charts are telling me. And I've become much more of a sort of simple technical analyst, that kind of approach, because it's all in the charts is my sense of it.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's sort of been my path too. And actually, you did just jog my memory of maybe the best economics book I ever read, which is called Economics in One Lesson by Henry Hazlitt. Economics in One Lesson by Henry Hazlitt. It's I think you could probably get it for free somewhere. It's basically if you're familiar with like the Frederick Bastiat kind of broken window fallacy. It's basically a whole book structured around that. But Pete, like what you were saying, I completely agree. It's funny. I started off as like a fundamental analyst. I got interested in the macro world. I kind of went up to the macro world. And then, you know, I really spent my last couple of years, like very recently, coming back out of the macro world and trying to do exactly what you're doing. How do I figure out, you know, how do I look for signals in the world try and invest according to that rather than having this very complicated framework that really, you know, it's pretty hard to use. And you can see even the best professionals can't do it.
I love that. It's funny how we've sort of got to a similar path through, you know, you're on one side of the world, I'm on another. Yeah. And you're listening to hip hop. I'm probably listening to heavy metal. We've got to a similar route.
Yeah, I think that's primarily because we all understand that economics is absolutely unfathomable and it's forever changing, you know, so that's probably why you're both on the same page, you know, from a long journey.
Yeah, I like to think it's because geniuses think alike, but my wife would definitely not disagree with that.
By speaking to us.
Seth, do not go there. Pete's head is big enough as it is, you know. Oh, Seth, it's been absolute delight having you on the podcast, mate. I'm sorry we haven't got enough time to keep you on for another half an hour. We're going to get through a few more bits and pieces over the next few minutes. But I think no doubt we're going to get you back here at some point later in the year, or if not next year. So it's been an absolute joy, mate. Thank you ever so much. Pete?
Thank you, Seth. I really enjoyed chatting to you. And it's been great to get my economic brain thinking again.
The pleasure's all been mine. Thanks a lot. It's been a blast. Yeah,
Thank you ever so much. We'll speak to you soon. Take care. God bless.
Whether you are an experienced or new investor, you know how valuable it is to conduct portfolio enhancing analysis and to have easy access to data that will give you the edge. As a Twin Peaks Investing podcast listener, you can access an exceptional offer via ShareePad from ShareScope, the UK's number one investment data and analysis software for private investors and traders. This special Twin Peaks offer is available to new subscribers only, and you can subscribe using the promo code TWINPEETS. The incredible and exclusive offer means that monthly subscribers will get their second month free, and annual subscribers will get their 13th month free. Sign up and subscribe to ShareePad today using the TWINPEETS promo code, and you can save up to £69. Visit shareScope.co.uk/sharepad for further details and subscribe to the investing and trading analysis and data you need.
Wow, Pete, you know, we've got a guy from across the pond, as they call it, calling you a genius. I don't know what it is, but I might have to check that he's okay.
I think he's been on something, mate. I mean, that's a scary thought.
Oh, mate. So what do you think of that, mate? Was that good?
I loved it. And I mean, it was great to have the view on inflation, because that is so, you know, relevant to what's going on at the moment. And yeah, really, really fascinating discussion. And, you know, it's frustrating that we've only got a certain amount of time, so we must have him on again.
Yeah. I can sort that out, mate. I can sort that out. I mean, for me, Pete, it's about the fact that I think sometimes we get very UK centric in our views about what's going on, and the fact is the vast majority of stuff that happens in the US impacts the UK. The vast majority of stuff that happens in the other parts of the world affects the UK. So inflation in the US affects the UK, and vice versa. So it's great to have somebody of Seth's standing and, you know, significant level of education and expertise coming on our little modest podcast, you know, and sharing that sort of, those sort of insights with our global listeners. So I can't be grateful enough for Seth for agreeing to come on.
No, it's brilliant. Thank you, Seth. Brilliant.
Cool. Pete, I wanted to go back. I touched on the markets, and we spoke about some stocks, and I was speaking about Apple and Google. Apple being 50% of the market waiting for the S&P 500, and they came out with some news on Tuesday. And Apple posted adjusted earnings per share of $1.30 compared with average analyst estimate of $1.01. And listen to this, mate. Quarterly profit of $21.7 billion for 3 months to June.
Just nuts, isn't it?
$21 billion. We've got companies that have got a market cap of that, if they're lucky. We've got a handful.
We've got 21
million in size. Oh, crazy. Alphabet, Pete, generated earnings per share of $27.26. Alphabet being Google, parent company of Google, ahead of consensus of $19.35, whilst generating a net income for the quarter of $18.5 billion in that second quarter. Yeah, we've got to remember that Google at the moment is the default search engine around the world, and Google still I think I'm getting the words right here, still has 92.5% of the search engine market. So as people doing all the various searches for various different things, it tends to be Google that they're using.
Also, of course,
involved in digital ads as well, and the cloud. Sorry, Pete, go on.
Funny you say that, because obviously the other the big competitor in, so I say big competitor, they're probably one of the only competitors to Google in search is obviously Bing, which is owned by Microsoft. What is it, MSFT
Bing is in a very distant second place, Pete.
Yeah,
it comes up
Bing
with 2.3%, followed by Yahoo 1.5%. You've got to remember back in when we first started investing, the go-to engine was Yahoo, and it's only got 1.5% of the market.
Yeah, incredible. But the amazing thing was, before we started recording the podcast today, Microsoft came out with really good numbers as well. And it's like, so even though they're absolutely nowhere with search, they're absolutely booming as well. And it's incredible because, you know, a lot of us have been skeptical about the rally in the NASDAQ and the strength of US tech stocks. But actually, a lot of these big ones are delivering the numbers. I mean, it's blinking impressive, really.
It's very impressive, mate. You've got Apple, ticker symbol, $AAPL. It's year to date, it's up 9.7%. Google, Pete, is up 80% year to date.
Wow.
Yeah, I haven't looked at Microsoft. I can find that for you. But what happened with Microsoft results? What did they say that they'd done? Do you know?
I can't remember, but it was things like, you know, is it Microsoft Azure?
The data set
that have done really well. And I guess the thing with Microsoft is, you know, they are so embedded. It's like probably if you're not using an Apple computer, you are using a computer that probably runs on Microsoft. You might have someone with a Chromebook that uses Android, but the vast majority is Microsoft.
Yeah, that's very, very true, mate. I've just pulled it up here now, and their net income for the quarter was, let me just find this properly, jumped 47% to $16.5 billion for the quarter. That's going some, isn't it?
You think, right, how big the scale of these companies is, and then they're growing at, what did you say, 45%? I mean, it's, you know, you can't even imagine startup companies managing 40%, 45% growth, and it's stunning.
You can't, and this is the problem. I think what we as investors tend to do, and this is a recurring problem, and it has been a recurring problem for me historically, maybe less so now, is I think, you know what, I can't afford to buy Apple, I can't afford to buy Google, I can't afford to buy Microsoft because the price has gone so far for so long. I'll try and find another company that's like that, or potentially in future could be that. The fact is, there is not going to be another Apple that does what Apple has done right now. Yeah. It is Apple. The fact is, there is a Microsoft now. There's not another Microsoft out there that's going to be a Microsoft in the next 1 year or 2 years. It is Microsoft. Yeah? And same with Google. That's it. Those companies are unique. And in 5 years, 15 years' time, there'll be another three or four unique companies that could potentially be and supersede them. But right now, if you want those three companies, you have to buy those three companies, not copycat companies, you know?
Oh, yeah. Do you know, it's funny because I was thinking about this earlier. I sort of kicked myself a bit because at the end of last year, I reduced my exposure to a tech fund that I had or have, and I hold PCT, Polar Capital Technology. I reduced my exposure, and you know, with hindsight and all the usual, I look back and I think, God damn it, I wish I hadn't trimmed that. But you know, I kept it, and I'm still running with it, so I'm not going to beat myself up too much. And I've obviously used the money elsewhere, and I've done okay this year, so I'm not going to be moaning. But it is funny how, you know, you make these decisions and you look back and you think, oh, my God, I could have played that better. But it's hindsight. It's hindsight.
It's hindsight. And I suppose that I've got to mention, you know, the hindsight thing is important to recognise. And you and me and a few others, we try to be as transparent as possible. And you do occasionally get the hindsight investor who, because the share price has gone up and it's done well or it's been taken over, all of a sudden they jump on your timeline and say, oh, I've got that too, I hold that stock too. Invariably they don't, but it looks good for the moment. But people are looking at these people and going, really? You've not mentioned this stock ever before, but here you are telling me that you've got it. It's just pointless. You know, you either got it or you haven't got it. And if there's a profit warning, it's down, it's getting a shellacking, a bit like, you know, Loop did for me last week. I hold my hand up and say, yeah, I've got that. you know, and it's gone full circle from 50p to £2.50 to back down to 50p. I've still got it. I'm still in profit in it. It's doing okay. And I haven't decided what I'm going to do with it yet. But bizarrely, last week, it was like tumbleweed. There was no one on Twitter talking about Loopup, just like there was no one talking about Fevertree last week. They've all gone. You know, no one's bought it. No one sold it, but they've disappeared.
It's funny because Woody Sue, who's a bit of a personality on Twitter, and she's very funny. And she said something today, and I thought, God, you're so right, girl. And she said, I like to tell people the good times and the bad times. When something goes wrong and I'm losing loads of money, I'll tell people and I'll mention it. And when things are good, I'll say things are good. And I thought, well done, Woody. That's damn good respect to you, because, you know, it's far more useful for other people on Twitter, especially the newbies and stuff, to see that it's not all roses. So many of these Twitter accounts, they never have a duff trade. Every trade some geezer the days, you know, his portfolio is up like 100% in a year, and it's like, yeah, whatever, you know. And you just think, what I think actually more than 100%, it's up like 1,000% on the year. You just think, it's just nonsense. They're just talking absolute rubbish.
Pete, it's what we've been saying for the past umpteen years on Twitter and the past 2.5, nearly 3 years on this podcast. There's nothing better than telling the truth. There's nothing better than telling it as it is, good, bad, or indifferent. If I've got a stock that's going up, I'll talk about it. If I've got a stock that's going down, I'll talk about it. That's the only way I'm going to learn. And I learn more from my mistakes than the stocks that have been successful for me.
Totally.
And that's the only way that people will learn, by being honest. So if you can share honestly what's going on with your portfolio and not make stuff up, not only will you learn, but the people that are following you on Twitter, and I don't mean following you in that sense, but following your account, they will learn. That's the reason why Seth Levine was on the show today, because I've learned so much from listening and watching and following his account. There's very few people on in our circles in the UK know who Seth Levine is, but I'm seeking people out like Seth that I can learn from. I believe in surrounding myself with people that are far brighter and far more intelligent than myself. I'd rather be the dumbest person in the room.
Seth
and others are teaching me and learning, and I'm learning from them, than being somebody who's pretending to be something that I'm not.
Mate, why are you on a podcast with me if you want to hang around with people? Anyway, I was just going to say something that Woody Sue added in her tweet, which was just bang on. She said, when I'm more honest, when I tell people how it is, I attract more followers. And she's so right. Mate, we need to talk about some stocks.
Go for it.
Right. Probably have to. How much time we got? Probably need to whisper.
We've got a few minutes, Pete. Let me stop you there. But before, otherwise, I will forget. I'm going to quickly do the charity shout outs, Pete. I want to thank everybody that's been supporting the Memphis fundraise that Pete and I have been doing via this podcast, the Twin Peaks Challenge. You can find, I forgot to mention it last week, you can find the fundraising link at justgiving.com fundraising Twin Peaks Challenge. And that's for a charity we're doing, for Memphis charity, supporting disabled children. We've had our great friend Elric Langton at Leamington Investor, who's donated another £105 just yesterday and a few more of the bits and pieces. I think that's almost taken Elric over £1,000 that he's donated to the charity so far. And what he's doing is at the moment providing us with 50% of the subs that he's getting from his various websites. So I wanted to thank Elric for that. Unfortunately, somebody misunderstood what Elric was doing on Twitter. I think it was just yesterday, maybe last night. But that's what Elric is doing. He's supporting a charity. He's doing a good deed. So if you can be as supportive as Elric has been, the person that was having a pop at him, please make a donation to the charity. The disabled children need it. So we've had somebody who's just put as anonymous, who's donated all the twos, £2 and 22 pence. So thank you ever so much for that. Scrumpy Triple Two has made another.
He's a good man, Scrumpy.
Yeah, another donation of £5 and £1.25 gift aid. What I've said to Scrumpy is that, dependent on whatever he's donated so far and what he donates between now and the 31st, I'm going to basically match that by the end of the year and make a further donation, depending on what Scrumpy does. We've had, I think it's Tompy, and he's put, "For open orphan info with thanks." I'm not sure we've spoken about that, but I think that's I think he's another person via Lemming Investors website. So he donated £10 and £2.50 gift aid. And then our friend on here, mate, we've had Ben at Go Left Master. Hello, Ben. Thank you for listening.
Hi, Ben.
And he writes, "Long overdue contribution. This is from my electronic penny jar for H1 2021. Well done on both the podcast and the charity efforts, Conkers and Wheelie. It is fantastic on both sides." Got a couple more, Peter. I'm just trying to just dash through these, mate. And Ben donated £48.67 and £12.17 gift aid. We had Ands Human, who donated £30 and £7 gift aid. "Your discussions go beyond what you hold individually, which is very refreshing. The transparency and knowledge you guys share for decades of experience is valuable to seasoned and new investors." And a little hand clap there. We had Jeffers45, donated £20 and £5 gift aid. "Thanks, Wheelie, for sharing your ideas and knowledge with other investors. Thanks also to your straight man, Conkers, a great team." I think this is your friend again. I think he's called something Hunt. Lotus East Sprint Lab.
Yeah, that's Paul. Hi, Paul.
Paul Hunt, I believe. Is that right?
Yeah.
Brilliant from Paul here. "Brilliant charity, and the podcast isn't bad!" Exclamation mark. Yeah. "This should get you through the £5,000 mark." Paul donated £100 plus gift aid.
Cool.
Absolutely brilliant. And "Just a Man Who Hates Pete's Jokes." That's what he's titled himself as, Pete.
Yeah.
"Great podcast and information. It deserves more, but I'm not that rich yet. But what you've done is give me a target where in the future I donate a set percentage of my annual gains each year. £10 plus gift aid." So thank you ever so much for that. And Faisal, at Faisal again, has made another donation. "Keep up the good work, gents. All the best." And he donated £10 and gift aid again of £2.50. "Terry, a brilliant podcast, and thanks for mentioning there might be value in supermarkets. And sorry for the small amount, but like Tesco's advert, every little helps. Ha ha. God bless and take care. £2. So that's us up to date, mate. That's us up to date.
Yeah, well, I wanted to give a quick shout out to Terry Vaughan. Lovely guy. I've had some email discussions with Terry, and I know he's going through a tough time at the moment. So you know, great to hear from you, Terry. And I think it might have been you who just donated the money. So there you go. Cool. And thank you to everyone who's done those donations, and to Elric, who's at Lemming Investor. Absolutely fantastic. Thank you, loads.
Yeah, I've spoken with the main guy at the Memphis charity, and I'm trying to organise something as we speak with regards to Lemming Investor, to show our appreciation of him and his subscribers. So I've got some ideas, Pete. I'm gonna I'll keep it close to my chest until we actually get it over the line. But we'll see how that goes. To everyone that's made a donation so far, thank you ever so much. For those of you that have thought about it and haven't done so yet, please join the Twin Peaks Challenge donating family and support the disabled children. Every single penny or pound you can spare will really, really go to some good use for these disabled children. So please support us at Just Giving fundraising Twin Peaks Challenge, and we look forward to giving you a shout out next week.
Fantastic.
Let's talk quickly some stocks, mate. Go for it.
Yeah, I'll try and whiz through. Simon Thompson in the Investors Chronicle every year does a little thing called his bargain shares. It normally comes out something like the start of February, yeah? Now, I remember distinctly looking through his suggestions, which was about 12 stocks, back in February, the start of this year. And there were two that really stood out to me, and that was Xar, X-A-R, and it was Brand Architects, B-A-R. Now, of those two, I didn't do anything at the time, but subsequently, and you can look on my website on the trades page and whatever, I did actually buy Brand Architect, B-A-R, so I've got some of those. But anyway, Xar, X-A-R, I didn't buy, but thankfully I tweeted it out and stuff, and I told other people about it, and it's done absolutely brilliant. So I'm sort of, you know, it's frustrating I didn't buy it myself, but but well done to the people who you know have acted on it, whatever.
We've put out a lot of tweets and a lot of commentary regarding stocks that people have done well out of, and one of them we mentioned some time ago after Ben Sharman asked me to have a little research of it was Hargreaves Services. You remember us talking about that many moons ago?
Was it HSP?
It was nearer to £2 when we talked about it, right? Guess where it is now?
Go on.
It's nearer to £5. It's £4.89. And it just keeps coming out with better and better and better news. So that's up over 100% plus since we last spoke about it. It's great to be able to share those sort of
that's incredible
companies with our listeners, and they go away and research it and profit from it. That's what we're here for, to help people to just give them ideas to go and research, and then they decide what they want to do with it. So I think Ben was already in it. So Ben's done well from £2.15, £2.20-ish to £4.89. That's nice.
Fantastic. Hi, Ben. On XAR, I just wanted to make the point that I think there's probably more upside in XAR. So, you know, if I was holding it myself, I would stick with it. If I didn't hold it, I'd be looking very carefully, thinking whether I ought to buy it. Obviously, as Pete says, we're not giving tips here. We're just talking about stocks. Do whatever you want to do, you know, whatever. Right. No, another one I'll just quickly mention. Pete, I think you've got RST Restore.
Restore, I have, yeah.
Mate, well done, because you've got another bid.
Yeah, sorry, I wasn't going to talk about it, Pete. Restore, yeah. If I sell it today, it would be my 47th bid takeover stock within 7 years. There's a lot of shenanigans going on. I think the person that's looking to acquire it, Marlowe, have been a bit sneaky. They've offered 71 pence of the bid of £5.30, which isn't going to wash. They're going to have to come back with more cash or a higher bid. I'm hoping somebody comes out now and makes a better bid for it, similar to Morrison's, which is in that bid situation. So, yeah, I'm hoping somebody comes in and does something else. I don't want Marlowe shares. I don't think these institutions want Marlowe shares. If not, they can walk away and the shares go back to, I don't know, mid £4, and eventually it'll get to the £5.30 on its own. We'll see what happens with that one, Pete.
Mate, I was just going to say, we talked about that on a podcast several times, and I would say maybe even 6 months ago. So, you know, there you go. Another one I'll just mention quickly. I spotted this morning, yeah? So this was Wednesday, the 28th of July. A company called JTC, which I don't know very well at all. It does like generic white label, I think the term is, white label, sort of like financial services stuff. So say, for instance, a bank or whatever wants to start a trading website, they'd go to JTC and JTC have the technology. I think, you know, there's a lot more to it. But I think it's that kind of thing that they do. Anyway, the point is, the CFO, the Chief Financial Officer, bought a load of shares yesterday or today, whatever it was. Bought a massive amount, like millions. So I thought I'd just flag that to people. You know, a direct to buy is always something I'm, you know, very, very interested in, especially if it's the CFO, because that's the guy who knows the numbers.
Yeah, I would completely agree with that, Pete, especially if it's sizable. I'm not really interested in when a CFO or a CEO buys 20 grand's worth. You know, when the average person that we speak to now is probably making purchases of 10 to 20 grand. You know, when they're making sizable purchases from their own pocket, and it's not options and blah, blah, blah. Pete, you're right to alert us to that one. So thank you for that. I wanted to mention, Pete, Barclays, which we mentioned a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah,
I was saying, you know what, I prefer my insurance companies, but guys, just keep an eye out, ladies, keep an eye out, because these banks have now been freed by the Bank of England to pay dividends, yeah?
Yeah.
And what do we have? We had the first bank out of the gate, Barclays, yeah, announced that they're going to be paying an annual dividend, which will be 6 pence per share. At the moment, that's a yield of 3.4% at the current price of 176. So they're starting off the blocks, and they're going to start paying a payout of about 1.8 to 2 pence, which was a nice surprise for the shareholders. and it caused the price to move somewhat. So yeah, so just keep an eye on those banks. I think they're going to be, I think the others are going to follow, because you know, if the other banks don't, then everyone's going to think, you know what, let me buy Barclays shares instead of Lloyds or NatWest.
Yeah, and I'd imagine if you look further out, so you know, if you look at a 1 year forecast, you're going to get what did you say, 3.6%, whatever it is.
Yeah,
but I bet if you look 2 years out, the forecast is probably for like more like 4%. So I suspect that's what we're going to see. Another one I want to mention very quickly is Acrl, A-C-R-L. Now, that's the one that's a company that got into a lot of trouble, yeah? It had a previous management and stuff, and they do toilet rolls, loo rolls, bog rolls, for like discount retailers. So people like B&M and Lidl and whatever probably get supplies from the likes of Acrl.
Pete, you keep mentioning this bog roll company. I'm not sure why you've got such a fascination with it. It must be the 15th time you've mentioned it. I'm not sure why.
You know me. It's toilet humour and nothing.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, and anyway, point is, it got itself in a right old pickle years ago. But that's all ancient history, right? But the point is, it's got new management in now. And I remember seeing a guy on a Mellow Monday presentation thing, you know, a few months ago. He's the CFO. He was really impressive. I thought, man, this guy is on it. You know what I mean? And he's really good. The interesting thing is the share price has dropped back loads over the last sort of, like, I guess over the last probably month or so or longer. It's just really dropped back. And I think the kind of levels it's at now, you know, there's really interesting looking value there, like a sort of 2 year forward PE of maybe 10 or less. It dare I say it looks quite cheap. So yeah. I don't hold it, you know. I'm probably not going to buy it because I'm not looking to buy anything at the moment, but I'm just throwing it out there. People can do what they want with it.
Okay. I'm going to mention one of my disclosure stocks again, Pete. I didn't do it last time, and I've mentioned about edging towards buying better quality stocks and preferring in this particular sector to buy insurance over banking. One of the stocks I'm going to share with you all, I do hold this stock. It's not a recommendation. It's something I bought with regards to it being a turnaround and also potentially them reintroducing dividends and recovering from their lows. And that is the insurer and underwriter Beazley. And it came out with results last week and reported better than expected results in the first half of the financial year. My disappointment regarding this was that it decided not to reinstate its dividend. It's come a long way from the lows already. It's going towards nearer to £4 now. I bought it nearer to £3 back in November of last year. The gross written premiums jumped 22% in the first 6 months to $2.03 million, with net earned premiums rising 14%. So it's on the right way. I'm hoping they keep their word and they'll review and start paying the dividend, because I want to get a bit more in my dividend portfolio so I can compound my dividends going forward. And Beazley should be one of them that's doing that.
So Beazley, that's B-E-Z, isn't
that's
it?
That's correct, yeah.
Mate, I'll just throw this in very fast. I wasn't going to mention it, but it just sprung into my mind. You mentioned Beazley Insurance Company. I came across a fairly new IPO listing. Today they had news of some sort, and that is called Conduit Holding, C-R-E, and it had results, whatever, and I had a quick look at it, and I thought, well, actually, you know, that actually looks quite interesting value with quite a nice dividend and stuff. It's only been going like 2 minutes, like a year or something, and maybe people want to have a look at that.
How long ago did that one list, Pete? Do you know?
Oh, I don't know. Like, let me just look on my phone very fast. Yeah, Conduit Holdings, CRE. Looks like it listed, I don't know, maybe 8 months ago, something like that.
Okay, I'm just wondering what it was called, something else before that.
I don't think it was. I think it's like a Bermuda-based reinsurance specialist, and it's quite a new thing and whatever, but I just think, I don't know, it's a new thing. I'm just saying, it's out there. People have a look at it. If you want to have a look at it, don't look at it if you don't want to look at it.
Okie dokie. I'm looking back here. It was admitted to London Stock Exchange in December. So yeah, so the first set of results maybe. It's an interesting one, Pete. We might have to go into detail a bit more about it another time.
Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah. I just like the look of the insurance companies. I've got another one that's sitting there. I'll disclose another time. But yeah, I think it's an interesting time regarding this reopening, and also what's going on regarding costings and all the rest of it. I think what I'm going to say in connection to what I said in the first 5 minutes about these costs that these employers and et cetera have got, just be mindful when you've got blue chip companies talking about costs, yeah, and logistics problems and costs regarding employees, yeah, that it's going to impact a lot of companies. So look out for the companies that are not giving guidance. And one of the companies that didn't give guidance just a couple of days ago, or this week, should I say, was Games Workshop. No guidance. What happened? Great results, no guidance. Market price got hit. If a company can't give you guidance as to what they're going to achieve, that's a red flag or slightly amber flag. So just be mindful. If they can't see what's going on, can't see what the costs are going to be, can't see how well they're going to do going forward, just be careful, folks.
Cool. Mate, I just want to mention very fast. First thing is, I'm not going to do a lateral thinking thing this week, although I know I owe the listeners one.
You don't owe them one, Pete.
I'll do it next time. But I keep saying that. But the other thing I'll just mention fast is there are still some spaces for the Wheelie Bash, which is on Saturday, the 4th of September. If you look on my website under the events page, or if you DM me on Twitter or email me, I can tell you all about it. It's free to attend, whatever. Mate, you know, few spaces left. You want to come, let me know.
Cool. I suppose the last thing I'm going to ask people to do, if they could be so kind, is that Pete and I are trying to reach as many eyes and ears as possible. And if you are listening and you don't normally listen via our YouTube channel, please can you just visit the Conquest Corner channel, which actually pushes out the Twin Peaks podcast. You can find it on my page, on my Conquest3.com website page. On every single article that goes out, we always put out the video link to YouTube. But please can you just subscribe to that channel, because we're trying to get a wider reach to another audience. The bulk of our audience is coming from Spotify, Google, Apple, iTunes at the moment, and we're just trying to just reach a few people from the YouTube channel. So please can you subscribe to that channel for us. Okay, Pete, what have you got left?
Thank you. I think that's it, mate. I think I'm washed up.
All right.
You've exhausted me.
Cool. Folks, ladies, gents, wherever you are in the world, thank you ever so much for listening to podcast, Twin Peaks podcast number 54. Please stay safe. Please look after yourselves. Please do what you can in the community for others. And above all, just be mindful of how blessed you are, because every day is another blessed day for you, me, and our loved ones. So take care. Be kind to others. Look after yourself. God bless.
Bye.
Bye-bye, folks. Oh, and before I go, thanks again to Seth Levine.
Yeah, thanks, Seth.
See you soon. Bye-bye.
This Twin Peaks Investing Podcast was brought to you in association with SharePad from ShareScope, the UK's number one investment data and analysis software for private investors and traders. Visit ShareScope.co.uk and discover the advantage.